Well, David, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
You know, people have talked about change initiatives, small ones, big ones, medium-sized ones, as long as I've been in business and been in the world. And it seems to be elusive how we reliably create change. And you have created something, a process that's part of a book called The Empowerment Valuation in Digital Villages, that I want to start with. What is the need for having a process ahead of change so that change can be effective?
You need basically a sort of what they call a theory of change so that people have a roadmap. My dad used to always say, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And that's, I think, true of social change. You have to have some theory, some idea about where we all want to go. And the idea, in my perspective anyway, is that it should be a partnership. It shouldn't be just a theoretical model. It should be one grounded in what people in the local community want or need, and help build that kind of roadmap sort of while they're running on it, is the metaphor I use in the book.
We know oftentimes change has been created by people who are, quote, experts, whether it's the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, or other experts in other communities, but they don't seem to get the essence of the true issues, nor do they create partnerships, as you're talking about, for success. So is the fundamental orientation that you have, you've got to get the people on the ground involved in the process from the beginning?
Precisely. From the anthropological perspective, it's called the emic or insider's perspective of reality. If you're not sort of getting the insider's perspective of reality, getting what people think, you're not going to go anywhere. And let me just highlight this point just briefly. In a lot of my classes at Stanford, people say, objective reality, that's all that matters. What do you mean, what people think, what they care about? I explained to them, I used to work in a VA hospital in a psychiatric ward where men thought that they could fly. Not like, you know, we fly in a plane, but fly. And whether you believe it or whether I believe it doesn't really matter, because there are real physical consequences for that perception of reality or behavior if they're on the third floor of a building with no bars on the window. So I don't always worry about whether it's something you can objectively agree with as that reality. If that's the perception, you work at least partially with that perception, but you don't let it go in a vacuum. You put it within the context of larger accountability. And that partnership idea, that's what is sustainable. I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about the idea that when experts come in, they're very often phenomenally bright, at the top of their game, but irrelevant, not even related in any way to where people are at their organizational stage of development or a personal stage of development. So that's why it has to be a partnership tied in, grounded in local control, local ideas, and local knowledge.
Now, you've done something that's quite interesting, which is you've talked about a project that links sort of academic orientation, corporate philanthropy, and real community need. You've taken some really challenged communities. You talk about in the book East Palo Alto, East Baltimore, and San Diego. Let's talk a bit about this project and what was the motivation to choose these communities?
Well, I think a number of them put out proposals and ideas about what they might be able to do. And HP was very interested in learning, which is fantastic. And I'll mention why I think this is really important in a second, because we're not talking about a foundation. We're talking about HP, the corporation, its philanthropic arm, but not the typical foundation idea that you think they're interested in liberal, progressive ideas and moving forward. Well, just as a backdrop to all this, we were funded at a tune of about $5 million for a different project related to this by a foundation who said we weren't moving fast enough. And HP came in and said, you know, David, we want to sit down with you. We actually like what you're doing and think we understand it's going to take longer because you're trying to build capacity. And we want to multiply that times three around the country and just make it bigger. And I was quite skeptical. They knew I'd be a little bit concerned. Why is this corporation coming in and trying to, as it were, save the day? And I asked them, what's your motivation? And they said, money. And I was like shocked at their honesty, but I was intrigued. And I asked them a little bit more. And they said, we're not trying to sell stuff to folks and make them buy stuff they don't need, software, hardware. But we are going to give equipment that has our name on it, and we do hope that they remember us when they do well in entrepreneurial efforts and that sort of thing. And I thought, you know, that's a fair enough deal. Once you're not pushing it down anyone's throat, you do want the branding, that's a fair trade-off for this kind of investment. So I just want to mention that as a backdrop, because a lot of folks think we're just talking about foundations, philanthropic efforts of that nature, but this is actually the corporation that understood the long-term investment versus the short-term aspect of just get in there, make a difference, and then unfortunately it falls apart because no capacity was built.
Right. So let's talk about these communities. What was the need these communities were trying to address?
Most of them were trying to improve the basic things like health, education, employment, but the idea of not being in a vacuum as HP's venue is that how do you want to do these things within the context of technology? So the big picture was how do you bridge the digital divide in communities of color? And HP wanted to learn from this experiment, as it were, or initiative, what could be done with from a local control perspective, but once again, within the context of what they had in mind, which is to help folks leapfrog, not just take all the same steps we've all have taken to move to where we are technologically, but to jump right to the level of video conferencing we have and that sort of thing, or web tools, et cetera. So the motivation is mostly to see if we can move people forward and help them help themselves so it becomes more sustainable over time.
What's some of the examples of things that could be done using technology that improve the economic health or the social fabric of a community?
Well, one example was the Tribal Digital Village in San Diego. That's composed of about 18 different Native American tribes. And keep in mind, you know, they were pretty much at odds with each other for other topics, but they came together for common denominator interest in moving forward with technology. And they built one of the largest wireless systems in the country, according to the FCC chair at the time. And they sold some of the bandwidth, but they were able to communicate not just within the reservation. And keep in mind, the Bureau of Indian Affairs many years ago broke up the reservation, so it's hard to communicate within the reservation, never mind to the rest of the world. They were able to communicate effectively within their own reservation and outside to my class at Stanford. They sold some of the bandwidth to be economically viable. They constructed a digital printing press in the process as well, once again with HP support and technical assistance. And my role was to evaluate how well it was doing, giving them feedback so they can improve and refine and reach their goals. These are just a couple of the accomplishments that they were able to make, as opposed to just relying, for example, on gaming. And many reservations, of course, don't even have gaming, so that wasn't even an alternative. But there are a number of them that wanted to step beyond that as their sole source or revenue stream, and this gave them a very nice alternative.
So what kind of long-term social impact is this having?
It's a number of different levels. It's very interesting. On the reinvestment level, in terms of youth, it's been fantastic. For example, in creating this wireless system, they had to build towers. They had to work on routers and get Cisco training. Well, the youth got involved in learning how to do some of the Cisco training work for the routers, which got them invested in the whole process. It sort of got them this buy-in. And in the process, they also, of course, are building their capacity to do other things, even outside this initiative, that are technologically oriented from an entrepreneurial perspective for financial viability. They're also able to improve their education systems by connecting with material on the net they didn't have in their own school system. Culturally, they're able to help buttress their museum efforts to maintain some of their artifacts, their cultural traditional items that were being lost in heritage. They did a lot of voice storytelling that was put on the web as well that was slowly being lost as the elders are dying. So a number of different areas. It mostly helped them become more and more resilient rather than a stigmatizing, victimizing kind of story. It became a story of how people could grab a hold of their lives and move forward.
Well, let's jump from San Diego to East Palo Alto. Very different set of circumstances. I used to live in the Bay Area, so I know how challenging that area is. What happened there?
Yes, that was very challenging, to say the least. That was fascinating. The big signature project was putting out laptops, hundreds of laptops, to kids in East Palo Alto and to the teachers. Now, that's, you know, not a big deal. It's mostly having the training, the resource on how to use these things, and then how to use these to transform the curriculum. And that's what they did to reshape exactly how the school system worked, making it much more updated rather than, as you can imagine, some of the older archaic books that they were using as textbooks. It brought things to life in a whole different way. So very powerful in terms of reassessing even the curriculum, what was valuable, what was not. I should mention also in the process, which is from an evaluation perspective kind of interesting, they started using some of the tools that I share about how you look, set up a goal and have some benchmarks and then look at your actual performance, compare with it so you can see where you're going. Are you actually getting there or not? They started doing that on their own in the school system. And just with the initiative, just with the technological things that we're talking about today, but other teachers started looking at this. And, you know, I used to be a high school teacher before I was a professor. And so I know how it works. And my mom was too. Before she was a professor, she was a high school teacher. It gets contagious. You start getting, hey, that looks pretty interesting. So slowly but surely, a number of the teachers and administrators started adopting the same self-assessment process called empowerment evaluation, without calling it anything in particular, but a way of monitoring what they're doing, assessing it, changing. So it had a lot of ripple effect, a lot of secondary effect, not just the effect of changing the curriculum, improving the quality, that sort of thing, getting people connected with the net, but these secondary benefits came across as well.
So do you look at this, what do you see the long-term benefit to the children? Education systems are helped. The children have a better opportunity as they move into adulthood. If we upgrade the educational infrastructure, if we bring more timely content, if we increase familiarity with technology, what's the impact on these young people as they move into adulthood?
I think a higher expectation in even themselves, and that's critical. I think the perception earlier, before all this, was really limited expectations, limited venue of what's possible. For whatever it's worth, technology is only a tool. It's how you use it. But the way in which this was used opened a lot of people's eyes, a lot of the kids, in terms of what's possible, what do they think they can make of their own lives. The number of individuals that got involved in after-school programs that were much more entrepreneurial or much more college-oriented started increasing dramatically. Why? It was, once again, contagious. Hey, if they're doing it, I can see on the web, and particularly on YouTube, guess what? I can do this. And some of it, of course, was involved in music. Some of the folks got involved in actually doing recording. So without judging which one is the most important direction, they started opening up in ways that they had never opened up before. And I think that concept of the modeling of what's possible and of trying these things themselves, applying to these things that they didn't even know existed, including, by the way, applications for college, were very impressive, very encouraging. Our hope, of course, is that this sets the tone for, you know, generation after generation. As they have kids, they have the same level of higher expectations than they had earlier. The same thing with the teachers. The teachers, they love the students, but their expectations were not that high in terms of where these kids could go. They thought they were being kind by being realistic in their expectations, but quite frankly, they were not being realistic. They didn't realize that there's a whole new world that could be opened up to them and change what kind of information they could get and what kind of access to employment issues, education, health issues for them and their families that they could get in seconds on the net. So it drastically changed the whole nature of everyone's level of expectations, and I think that's probably one of the more sustainable items. The other one, of course, is that it allowed people to see how relatively easy it is to get information compared to being in this vacuum or into this sort of mythology of just word of mouth of what is possible to do in the world. So it made things very practical.
So let's move now from East Palo Alto to East Baltimore. What were the issues there and what's happened?
That was fascinating. I should preface it by the fact that I'm very straightforward and very honest in the book. We had phenomenal successes, but we also had some major detours and problems and mistakes and that sort of thing. Baltimore did very well in terms of helping to transform school systems and everything else, as I mentioned, just like East Palo Alto was distributing laptops. But they also made major blunders and mistakes, one of which was pretty interesting, was they, in the early phases of the initiative, uninvited the sponsor, HP. That's kind of unheard of in the funding world that I operate in. And HP was very understanding. They said, oh, no, it's their show, you know, and if they're not ready, then that's fine. And our role in evaluation, we probably made a mistake and should have stepped in and said, well, I'm not sure that's the wisest move, but everyone let it move forward. And the problem is they developed an organizational arrogance that pushed away all sorts of help that came in the process in the name of self-control. So eventually it all caught up with them and they realized that this is maladaptive, not very effective. And it did turn around through evaluation feedback, through basically their lack of progress. It took an awful long time, a lot longer than the other sites, to move forward. And they then dramatically shifted gears and stopped what they were doing and moved forward with a lot of their educational activities and entrepreneurial activities to help get startup companies moving, small micro businesses, et cetera, in the community. So it became very productive, but I don't want to give the impression it was all wonderful and everything moved smoothly. There are a ton of mistakes and detours, and Baltimore, unfortunately, highlighted a lot of the things that kind of mistakes that are easy to make in comprehensive community initiatives. In the spirit of being respectful, you can go too far and not step in. If you truly are what I call a critical friend, you care about the group, you like the group, you believe in what they're doing, but if you really are a friend, you'll tell them where that doesn't make sense, that's not realistic, or the data doesn't support this, or what have you. So Baltimore was an interesting example where we were very effective, but only sort of at the last minute in the race, as it were. And we could have gone a lot further if we had maybe mid-course corrections earlier.
So what was the underlying social issue that was having that group want to push away, if you will, a very strong potential partner?
They did not get what some of the other groups understood earlier, and that is there had to be what's called a there. In other words, they were the only ones unwilling to create a 501c3 or some sort of corporate entity or bond. They were still too busy competing with each other because none of these are just small nonprofits and businesses, et cetera, in the community that are coming together to try to have this unified effort in the community. And they had a very difficult time getting past the normal competitive basis that most of us operate in, and certainly a lot of the nonprofits. One of the things that empowerment evaluation was useful in doing is coming into these different communities that had a lot of cultural baggage and politics and everything else. You know, I'm not trying to save everybody, not trying to make everybody wonderful and happy. All I want to find is where are the common links and the common vested interests. So if you're interested in improving education, great. You're all interested in improving security in the community, great. You're not all interested in housing, you are, but you're not, then great, we won't deal with that one. So what empowerment evaluation has been able to do in each of these communities is find the common vested interest. It's really a chance to say, here's what I want to do, put it on the table, and then find where we have common links, not focus on all the differences that we're not going to work on or solve. Once again, we're not here to make peace with everyone. We just want to find where our common interests are and bond together on those. And that's where we were the most effective.
So as you look forward with the successes you had and the learning you had, what do you see happening with the world of corporate philanthropy and local communities?
I see that I'm just part of a larger movement, I think, that's happening throughout the United States and to some degree around the world, because I work also in Nepal and Japan, a number of countries outside the United States. And what I see going on is very interesting. I see in government, for example, Obama administration, they're moving towards this kind of thing with their neighborhood revitalization initiative. It's part of their White House Domestic Policy Council. I see it in foundations like the Marin Community Foundation, Andy Casey Foundation, MacArthur, all moving more towards a collaborative participatory approach. So when you ask about what do we think about it within corporate philanthropy, I think this is the time to step in more than any other time. Look, industry has a role to play. Government has obviously a major role to play. But philanthropy, corporate philanthropy, has this wealth of knowledge about what has worked and what has not worked. And they can jump in and keep developing these partnerships, which is what works. Not the hierarchical, I'll tell you what to do top-down, has not worked. Yes, it's worked for short term, I should say, but there's no sustainability. It doesn't last because there's no ownership. This partnership idea is a key model that works, that corporate philanthropy can step in and help with their part of dealing with what's going to be the aftermath of the fiscal cliff that we're all dealing with at the moment.
Wonderful work that you've been doing. Thank you so much for being part of our program today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.